Rádióegyetem. Rich Lohmann, Measuring Size and Distance in Astronomy. Méret és távolságmérés a csillagászatban. Angol nyelvű előadás. A felvétel az első pesti egyetemi rádió stúdiójában 2005. decemberében készült.
Good morning, or good afternoon, whatever the time may be for you. My name is Rich Lohmann. I'm a retired teacher from California, the United States, and I've been retired about 2.5 years. I taught for 34 years in a secondary high school in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I taught students with the age range of approximately 13 to 18. At the beginning of my career, I was teaching various levels of mathematics, beginning with what we call general math, and then to algebra. And moving on several years later, I taught physical science and life science, more introductory sciences for our students. At one point, I taught electronics for 2 or 3 years. And then finally, in the last 10 to 12 years of my career, I began to teach physics and ultimately connected astronomy to physics and taught them simultaneously. And what I found in teaching astronomy or teaching physics with astronomy was that I could teach mathematics and physics more easily because the students were very attracted to astronomy. And they were interested in things out in the universe. And when I had added computers to that, and we could have the students using real astronomical images, then it was a very wonderful combination. Because at that point, then all these things combined could be a very powerful teaching tool. There is a program that I've been involved with for about 15 years called Hands-On Universe. And that particular program, begun in the United States, but extended here now into Europe, and most recently here in Budapest, combines these kinds of tools, using real astronomical images on computers in teaching math, physics, and astronomy. So I'd like to begin this talk by talking about what we see with a telescope. What does a telescope give us? Particularly a telescope connected with a camera where we can record the images. Telescope basically gives us something very simple, a picture created by light. And I'd like to emphasize that that's really all it does. It's so simple, and yet it's very amazing what we can do with that. If you compare what our eyes do with light, we have two eyes with very tiny holes in them. And through those tiny holes, we call the pupils, the light comes in, and that combined with our brains gives us the power to see wonderful things, images, objects, color, distance, perspective, shapes, all those kinds of things that we can do just with this very little light that comes into these two holes in our head. We actually see, in more mundane terms, we see location, we see position. Then with our telescopic images, we can see the changes that occur over time, such as a star moving, a planet moving, a star getting brighter or dimmer, two stars getting closer together. We can see moons orbiting around a planet, those kinds of things. We can also see or at least make some measurement as to how far away one thing is from another. We can see how large things are. And finally, if we put onto the telescope a simple filter, or even a little more complicated, a spectrophotometer, we have a measure of a color. That is, the light coming from a star, for example, comes in many colors, although we normally see a star as perhaps white or yellowish, maybe even red, sometimes bluish, but the star is actually radiating many more colors than that, essentially all the colors of the rainbow. And by measuring the amounts of each of the colors, we can determine a lot about the star, including how hot the star is, what's the temperature. So I'd like to point out that with a telescopic image, with a camera, with an picture, we can find out such amazing information about the universe. And keep in mind that the only thing we're measuring is light. So now with the Hands-On Universe software, as I mentioned earlier, I have had my students actually measure many of these things on the computer and then make subsequent calculations do drawings, do apply geometry, algebra, sometimes trigonometry or calculus to those images or to the data from the images. And they've been able to determine many things about the astronomy that's related to that. And in some cases, don't even realize they're learning mathematics or physics because they like the astronomy so well. So let's talk now about what astronomers are particularly interested in the universe. There's a strong interest in general in the scale of the universe. How large is the universe? And how far away are things? And how fast are they moving? So I'd like to spend a significant portion of what I'm talking about, how we measure size, and then later talk about how we measure distance. So how do we measure size? As we look in the sky, or as we look at a telescopic image, size can be very deceptive. We only have a relative view of the sky, at least from the simple image. For example, we see stars in the sky which look like very small pinpoints of light, perhaps a little bit larger than that. They seem very tiny, and yet we now know that some of those stars are perhaps 10, hundreds, thousands of times more massive and larger than our own sun. So it's a very deceptive kind of a view. The other thing about size in astronomy is that whereas in physics or many of the other sciences, we're used to measuring distance or size in meters or kilometers, in astronomy, the astronomers measure size generally in what is called angular size, something to do with an angle, which I'll be talking about here. And the usual unit in angular size is called the arcsecond. I'll come back to that in a little while, but the arcsecond is actually related to the basic unit of angle, which is called the degree, as you probably know. So what is angular size? I'd like to take the example of our moon, and here's where I'd like you to use your imagination a little bit and picture the moon on a night when it's a full moon. It's just rising over the horizon. And imagine that you could take a very, very, very long piece of string, put one end at your eye, and extend the other end of the string all the way out to the moon, let's say to the left-hand side. So there's a piece of string running from your eye to the left side of the moon. Then I'd like you to take another piece of string, the same length, again start it from your eye, and move it out to the moon, but this time to the right side of the moon. Now, if you can imagine that, I hope you can then picture what this would look like. It would be a very, very long, thin triangle. At one end would be your eye. At the other end is the moon. And the angle between the two strings, very, very tiny angle, we would call the angular size of the moon. And imagine that angle extending out all the way to the moon. So I'm going to ask you a question to stimulate your thought a little bit about this. I wonder how much you think that angle actually is. Now, our usual measurement, as I mentioned, for an angle is the degree. 1 degree, 2 degrees, 360 degrees in a full circle, 90 degrees for a right angle. I'm sure you're used to those measurements. What do you suppose the angle of the moon is, the angular size of the moon? It's a very well-known number to some people, and some of you might even know that. For those of you who don't, I'd like you to take a moment and make a guess, just some kind of a guess. And the clock is ticking here. I'm not going to give you more than about 10 or 15 seconds, but we could even play a little music, but we won't do that. You'll just hear my voice. Okay, your time is up. So what did you come up with? 5 degrees, 10 degrees, 2 degrees, maybe 1 degree, smaller, bigger? Okay, the answer is 1/2 degree, almost exactly 1/2 degree, the angular size of the moon. And you know that's a very tiny angle on anything that we normally measure. So now here's a little additional question. A very simple answer, but maybe it'll cause you to think a little bit more. What about the angular size of our sun? What do you think that is? Of course, you're not going to be going out in the daytime and looking directly at the sun and putting those two strings out there. But if we could measure the angular size of the sun, what do you suppose it is? And again, the clock is ticking just a bit here, a couple of seconds. Okay, I hope you came up with the same answer, 1/2 degree. Almost exactly. And of course, both of these angles depend a little bit on where the moon is or where the sun is in its orbit around the Earth or Earth's orbit around the sun. But approximately, they're the same. And some of you would have realized that the angular size of the moon and of the sun must be the same because it wouldn't have a solar eclipse otherwise. The fact that the moon exactly blocks the sun during a solar eclipse means that it has exactly the same angular size. I'd like you to realize that, I know you know this, that the moon and the sun are not the same actual size. In fact, that the moon is hundreds of times smaller than the size of the sun. But because of their relative positions, they have the same angular size. So another question related to the angular size. Sometimes I ask my own students, pick the coins out of your pocket. In the United States, we have nickels and dimes, pennies, quarters, 50-cent pieces. Our smallest coin is a dime, 10 cents. So here in Hungary, you have 54-ence and 24-ence and 10-4-ence and 5 and 2. I think about this particular experiment. Suppose you took a coin, whichever coin you would like to choose in your system here, and held it out at arm's length. So maybe, depending on how long your arms are, but maybe it would be 70 centimeters, 80 centimeters, out in front of your face, out in front of your eyes. Which coin would be needed to exactly block out the full moon? Would it be the 50 or the 20 or the 10 or the 5 or the 2 or the 1 or something smaller or something larger? And it's got to cover 1/2 degree, keep in mind. Well, the clock is ticking once again. My guess is that, not really a guess, but looking at the coins that I've seen, it would be about the size of 1/2 a 2/4 piece. In my case, it's even smaller than our smallest coin, which is a dime. Something easier than coins is just to hold one of your fingers out in front of your eyes and block out the moon. And you would find typically for an average person that just holding out your smallest finger at arm's length, at an arm's distance, is just about the right thing to block out the moon. So, angular size, the angle that an object takes up in the sky. As we've seen now, the moon and the sun are our largest objects at 1/2 degree. Or actually, we haven't seen that yet. But if you think about the objects that we see in the sky, the moon and the sun are the largest. The planets are much, much smaller than the moon or the sun in terms of how we see them. And so if the largest objects are 1/2 degree in angular size, then the degree is a very, very impractical unit of measure to measure angular size. So there's a new unit that's been developed by astronomers, and I'd like to go, this is just a little bit of mathematics, relatively simple conversion. The 1 degree has been divided into 60 pieces, and we say that's 60 minutes of arc. Or 60 minutes of angle. 1 degree is 60 minutes of angle. Keep in mind that it's like the hour and the minutes, where 1 hour is equal to 60 minutes. 1 degree is equal to 60 minutes of arc. And going further, just like we have 1 minute is equal to 60 seconds, we have 1 minute of arc is equal to 60 seconds of arc. So if you work that out a little bit, you will realize that 1 degree is made up of 3,600, that'd be 60 times 60, arc seconds. Converting that around, one arc second, if you do a decimal fraction and take the decimal, it's a very, very small number, 0.00028 degrees, one arc second being a very small angle. So an angle of this size, a one arc second, being 1/3600th of a degree. Very tiny, hard to visualize. I'd like to give you an image perhaps that you can visualize about how large an arc second is. If you take two 1-meter sticks, one on top of the other. So you've got these 2 meter sticks laid out on a table. One is on top of the other. And you leave one end closed. And at the other end, you lift up the meter stick and insert one sheet of paper, just a simple sheet of paper, so that that end of the 2 meter sticks is just very slightly open, and the other end of the 2 meter sticks is closed, kind of like a hinge. It's a little bit hard to visualize this because it's so tiny, but the end that's closed would be the what we call the vertex of the angle, and the end that's open is the open end of the angle. There's an angle formed by the 2 meter sticks. That angle is approximately 25 arc seconds. So even with a sheet of paper opening a 2 meter sticks, the angle of one arc second is practically impossible to even create so that you can see it. So I'd like to end this portion by just showing, giving you some examples of what the angular size is of several objects that you probably know about. Beyond the moon and the sun, which are our largest objects, our planets are the next largest objects in the sky. And for example, the planet Venus has an angular size when it's at maximum angle of 60 arc seconds. Jupiter, when it's at maximum, is 45 arc seconds. Saturn is 18 arc seconds. And then the one that I think is the most interesting or of most interest right now currently because it's so very close to the Earth and large compared to other times is the planet Mars. This year in November, Mars was at 20 arc seconds, so a little bit larger than Saturn even. In December, it's moving from about 17 down to about 12 arc seconds toward the end of December as it moves away from the Earth and becomes smaller and smaller. And ultimately, probably a year or so from now, Mars will be down to as small as around 5 arc seconds. So it's quite a range. But astronomers consider 20 arc seconds or even 25 arc seconds, which it was 2 years ago in August of 2003. It's a wonderful time for astronomers to view Mars. And I had the opportunity myself to use my own telescope and camera to take images of Mars 2 summers ago, which were very striking because of the size that it was at the time. And finally, for reference, all galaxies that we might look at, if we looked at the entire angular size of any galaxy that we could see, would be anywhere from a few arc seconds to fractions, decimals of arc seconds. The one exception is the Andromeda Galaxy, which, again, I suspect you know is the closest galaxy to the Milky Way galaxy in which we live. The Andromeda Galaxy is approximately 2 degrees an arc second, so it's a really large angular size. Of course, it's so far away that it's very, very dim normally, but with a simple telescope or even a good pair of binoculars, it's possible to view the Andromeda Galaxy. If I go back to the Hands in the Universe software for a few minutes that we have talked about, we can actually measure angular size on the images by using the software. We can calibrate our images so that we know directly as we measure across an image how what the angle is. We actually look at the pixels in the images, the digital images, and each pixel is worth so many fractions of it. It might be at one arc second or half an arc second or a third of an arc second or something like that. But we can actually measure that with our software. So that's how we measure angular size. But then there's the other issue that we have in astronomy, which is the idea of actual size. How many kilometers, for example, is the moon, or how many kilometers or other measure is the size of Jupiter or Venus? So the question is, how do astronomers do that? So I'd refer you back to that very, very long triangle that I suggested that you create with the two pieces of string from your eye to out to the moon. And in that long triangle, in mathematically speaking, there are essentially three variables. There is the angle we talked about. There is the distance from your eye out to the moon or out to the object. And finally, there is the, in this case, the diameter of the moon. So three variables: angle, distance, and essentially actual size of the object. In mathematics, there's a very simple, I should say, in the combining mathematics in the field of geometry and with this triangle, there's a very simple relationship between those two variables. And much like the familiar equation in algebra where we have distance equals rate times time or distance equals velocity times time, where if you know two of the variables, you can calculate the third. In this particular example of astronomy, if you know two of the variables, you can calculate the third. Angle is usually the easiest to measure, and then either we have to measure the size of the object or the distance in order to determine the other one. So, how about distance? How do we measure distance, or how do astronomers measure distance? Astronomers use something called a distance ladder. And what the distance ladder is a set of perhaps as many as 10 different techniques of measuring distance that build upon each other. Just like a ladder has rungs, steps, where you step on one to get to the next, to the next, to the next. In astronomy, when we measure distance, we measure a short distance first, then that's the step to build to the next level of distance, a little farther out, and then go another step and measure farther out, and so on and so forth. There are many techniques, and techniques are used depending on the distance to the object. So I'd like to talk about two that I'd like to focus on, primarily because when I have had students work on these concepts, I've had them work on these particular ones. So there are four that I would like to mention, and then I will focus on two. One is called parallax, the measurement of parallax. Another depends on a certain type of star called a Cepheid variable star. A third depends on measuring the brightness of a supernova or many supernovae, exploding stars. And the fourth one that I would mention here relates to measuring Doppler shift or redshift of objects as they move through space, in most cases directly away from us very fast. So let's start with the concept of parallax. This is a topic that I've always enjoyed teaching because the students can have fun with it. They can go outside and see how it works. It's something that's quite easy to see. There's a little bit of mathematics involved in it, but relatively simple geometry and algebra. So I'd like to give you another experience that gives you an idea of what parallax is. What I'd like you to do is hold your thumb out in front of your face, kind of mid-range. It doesn't have to be all the way out. You don't want it real close, but hold it out in front of your face. Close one eye, and then look at the thumb with that one eye and notice the background behind it. Notice what is behind it in the background, maybe a wall behind your thumb, a picture, a machine, something that's behind the thumb. So I'll repeat what I just said. You're holding the thumb out. You have one eye closed, and you're looking at your thumb. Now, without moving your thumb either right or left, or without moving it closer or farther away, close that one eye, open the other eye. And it would be probably helpful to continue shifting your eyes back and forth, open one, close the other, and so on, back and forth. And I hope that you're noticing that as you see your thumb, it appears to be shifting in the background behind your thumb. It will go to the right, go to the left, right, left. Now, one thing that's you should be able to see, if you move your thumb a little closer to your face and you do the same process of shifting your eyes, you will see the shift be even more than before. And on the other hand, if you move your thumb far away from your eye, as far as you can, and you blink your eyes open and shut, you will see the shift less. So the words associated with what we're talking about here are the words parallax shift. you have seen the thumb appear to shift, even though you haven't moved it. There's an apparent shift due to looking at that thumb from two different points of view, from your right eye, then your left eye. So we call that parallax shift. And the parallax shift is always greater the closer the object is. And as you, if you had the possibility of moving your thumb all the way to the wall and shifted your eyes back and forth, you would see no shift at all because it's right on the background. So to take this a little step further, and this is exactly how I introduce this to my students, if you imagine yourself going outside, and going outside where you might be able to walk on a sidewalk or on a lawn or something like that, and where there's a tall tree maybe 20, 30, 40 meters away. And so you look at that tall tree from wherever you're standing in the moment. You stand directly and face the tree, look at it, look at what is behind the tree, far away, maybe some houses behind it or the hills behind it or something like that. Now, this is equivalent to what we did earlier in the fact that you were standing there. Now you're using both eyes, but the tree is like your thumb, and the background, the houses or the mountains, is like the background of the wall in the room where you were before. So as you're facing the tree, look where the tree is located in the background. Now, turn either to your left or to your right, 90 degrees, and then walk about 10 meters as though you were going to another spot to view that tree. Move, walk about 10, it wouldn't even have to be 10 meters, maybe 5 meters. And then turn and face the tree and see what's now behind the tree. And you should be able to notice that the tree appears to have moved according to the background because there's a different background behind it than it was before. Once again, you've seen a parallax shift. It's the same tree, it's in the same position, it has not moved. And yet, because you have moved, you have changed your position, you're seeing an apparent shift in its position, a parallax shift. I should note that the more that you walk left or right along what we call the baseline, the more parallax shift you get. So now, let's apply this to astronomy. If we look at the stars and the planets at nighttime, say, and we look up in the sky, we're using both of our eyes, we open one eye, close the other, and shift back and forth, we're not going to see any change in the position of the stars and the planets. There's no parallax shift. On the other hand, astronomers have discovered that, wait a minute, there may be a way of taking a picture of the stars or the heavens from a far distance, from two different distances. And so sometimes they do this two different ways. In one case, they will take images on the same night at exactly the same time of the same star field from two different telescopes, one from, say, California and one from the East Coast, Washington or New York or somewhere like that. And because they're far enough apart, if they do this particularly with the moon, they will see the moon shift a little bit because the moon is relatively close. If they do with stars, chances are they're not going to see enough. But on the other hand, if they take images of a certain star field in January and then wait 6 months to July and take another image, because the Earth is now in a totally different position relative to the sun, it has gone halfway around the sun, it has moved from one side of the sun to the other, the position of the first image and the position of the second image are what we call two astronomical units, which happens to be around 300 million kilometers apart. So it's as though we have taken an image and then walked for 300 million kilometers to another spot and taken the same image, one in January, one in July. And when we take these pictures, we see that we get parallax shifts of all the planets and many of the nearby stars. I have not really described the mathematics involved here, but it's a very simple geometry and a very simple, essentially algebra calculation to do this calculation. And with that measurement, using the Earth in its two positions 6 months apart, astronomers are able to measure distances out to approximately 100 light years or so in that particular range. So I've just talked about measuring distance to relatively nearby objects, planets and stars, particularly stars, out to about 100 light years. So that's 100 light years, a very large distance. On the other hand, just to get the idea that we're talking about the Milky Way being about 100,000 light years in diameter means that we're still in our Milky Way, and if we're interested in measuring objects out beyond our Milky Way, we need other techniques. So the other technique I'd like to focus on in the distance ladder that I mentioned is based on a particular law of physics. And this is a very powerful law that astronomers use, and also people interested in optics and other things where light is involved. This is what's called the inverse square law of light intensity. There are many inverse square laws, or certainly quite a few famous laws. The one that you might be familiar with in physics is the law of gravitation that Sir Isaac Newton developed. It's an inverse square law. Another very widely used one is the inverse square law related to electric force between electric charges. So I'd like to explain for those of you who don't know what an inverse square law is, just how it works in the case of light intensity. I'd like to use example of a 100-watt light bulb. And we would call the 100 watts the light bulb's luminosity. It is the amount of energy per second that the light bulb emits in all directions. It's the inherent energy of the light bulb. So if we set the light bulb just 1 meter away from us, and we measure the brightness of the light bulb with some kind of a photometer or light measuring device, we would measure about 8 watts per square meter. Now keep in mind that out 1 meter, this light is going out in all directions, and we're just at one particular position away from that light. So there's a lot of light that's going out in other places that we're not capturing. So we capture at that one spot, we capture in this particular case 8 watts per square meter. We would call that the brightness or the intensity at that particular spot, as opposed to the luminosity. The luminosity is the inherent energy of the light bulb, the 100 watts. The brightness or the intensity is the amount of light falling on a square meter at a particular distance. With stars and with astronomy, we usually use the term brightness for that. So now we move out another meter. So we're now 2 meters away from that light bulb. The intensity is now down to 2 watts per meter squared. So we've gone from 8 watts per meter squared at 1 meter to 2 watts per meter squared at 2 meters. I'd like you to note that it's gone from, and going from 8 to 2, it has gone down a factor of 4. Even though we have only doubled the distance, the amount of reduction in the brightness is a factor of 4, or 1/4, 2 squared. That is in an inverse square law. If we were to carry the light bulb out, or if we were to move our light meter out another meter, so we were now 3 meters away, we would be reducing it down to a factor of 1/9, the original, 1/3 squared, the inverse square law. So this is a very well-known law. It applies to light bulbs, it applies to candles, it applies to any light source, including stars. So in the case of the light bulb, because this is a well-known law, let's stay with the 100 watts. If we know that, if we know the light bulb is 100 watts, and then we measure its brightness at some distance away, let's call that X for the moment, then because of this well-known law, we can actually calculate the third variable, which is distance. It's a very simple calculation, basic algebra. I'll go through that again. If we know the light luminosity, which is 100 watts, if we measure its brightness, I'll call that B. So we now know two variables. There's a simple equation to relate luminosity, brightness, and distance. And so just like in an earlier case where we talked about an equation with three variables, this is another equation with three variables, and the distance can be calculated if you know the other two. So with stars, we don't have 100-watt light bulbs. So what do we have? Do we have standard stars? That's really what we need. If we know light bulbs, we're fine, but we can't go out in space and just say, well, let's see, which stars are standard and which ones aren't. But interestingly enough, astronomers have come to that realization that there seem to be standard stars, and that they're often referred to as standard candles. So the particular one that I'm talking about here is a supernova. And just for your information, I may use this word later. The word supernovae, A-E, is the plural of supernova. A supernova is an exploding star. It's a very bright star. It happens very suddenly from not being seen to all of a sudden getting very bright at its maximum spot. Sometimes it is larger. It is probably brighter than the entire galaxy. And therefore, it can be seen at great distances. And astronomers really like finding supernovae because then they can see this out at a great distance. And the farther distance they can see them, the more possibility they have for measuring distance. There are many types of supernovae. They're type 1 and type 2. And within those categories, there are type 1, A, B, C, type 2, various categories. So the specific one that astronomers believe is a standard star or a standard candle is called a supernova 1A. It appears to be a standard candle, meaning that it has the same maximum luminosity whenever it explodes. Wherever, whenever, once it gets to its maximum brightness, whatever supernova it is, it's the same luminosity. And the reason for that, at least as astronomers believe, is because of the mechanism of this particular star exploding. A supernova 1A begins with a small white dwarf star, very tiny white star, which actually was a much larger star in its earlier lifetime. And if this small white dwarf star is near a companion galaxy, it will tend to pull mass away from that companion galaxy. So it will accumulate more and more mass. And there's a very interesting number that's related to this. If the mass gets up to exactly 1.4 times the mass of the sun, 1.4 solar masses, then precisely at that moment, the star explodes. And if that's happening in each case where there's a supernova 1A, then with that particular mechanism, it should have the same kind of brightness every time. So if we see a supernova, we measure it, we measure its brightness, and since it's a standard brightness, standard luminosity, going back to the idea of the standard 100-watt light bulb, we have measured its brightness, we know what its standard luminosity is because it's a supernova 1A, we can calculate the distance to the supernova. And so because the supernovae tend to be very far away, or they can be, and we can see them because they're so bright, that allows astronomers to measure distances very far away with supernovae. Specifically, we can see supernovae in the billions of light years away, and we can establish that kind of distance out to those particular stars. And in this particular case, the stars are associated with a galaxy, and so we, by measuring the distance to the star, by measuring the distance to the supernova, we are actually as well measuring the distance to the galaxy. This is where the contribution to something called measuring the Hubble law comes into play, and because this is related, I thought I would kind of end with talking a little bit about the Hubble law. Usually when astronomers measure a supernova, They not only measure its brightness, but they measure its spectrum. And a spectrum means they will measure, use a spectrophotometer, they will measure the light coming at the various colors, and they will also be able to measure where various spectral lines are coming from, which determine the gases and elements that are in that supernova. And that allows them to determine whether it's a supernova type 2 or a supernova type 1A or 1B or whatever it is. In the process of measuring the spectrum, it also, interestingly enough, allows them to measure the speed of the supernova as it's moving through space, or the speed of the galaxy as it's moving through space. And this is actually very much related to what Hubble did years ago, Edwin Hubble, as he made the discoveries that galaxies were, in fact, far away from our current galaxy, that galaxies are moving away at a very fast speed. He was able to see that the spectral lines in the spectrum that were taken by the galaxies indicated that there was a shift in the spectrum. Now, we call that shift a Doppler shift. And as I talk to my students, I introduce the idea of Doppler shift with the following. I suppose that on the radio you could still get the idea. I have students imagine standing on a street corner, looking to the right, and a small motorcycle is coming toward them from the right. And as it passes them, they hear the sound, and then it hear the sound differently as it passes them, and it goes something like this. That's the Doppler shift. And I might be a little more dramatic with my students, but at any rate, there's a change in the pitch of the sound. It's more like, we don't hear stars, but stars, instead of putting out sound waves, put out light waves, as we talked about. And as stars or galaxies are moving, they send out a spectrum, they send out light waves that are at a different frequency, a shifted frequency, a Doppler shifted frequency, because of their speed. And the faster they're moving, the more they're shifted. So it was Hubble that discovered that galaxies that are very far away have what we call a red shift. The light is shifted toward the red end of the spectrum, meaning that they are moving very fast, far away from us. The measurement of supernovae and the spectral lines from the supernovae add data to the data that's been accumulating over many, many years that's related to what's called the Hubble law. Hubble stated that the distance out to a galaxy was related to, directly proportional to, its speed or its redshift. That is, if a galaxy were going relatively slowly and had a low redshift, it would be a nearby galaxy. And if a galaxy had a very high speed or a high redshift, large redshift, it would be a very distant galaxy. He stated that he believed that they were directly related, directly correlated, and a linear relationship. So, in effect, the Hubble law says that if you know the redshift, you can determine the distance. And it also implies the other direction. If two objects have the same redshift, they have the same distance. So the Hubble law has actually as well been a way of measuring distance out to objects that are very far away by astronomers measuring the redshift, which is quite easily with modern-day techniques measured with a spectrophotometer. They can infer from that and determine from that the distance out to the object. This is called the Hubble law, and it's used by astronomers, and they're constantly adding data to support it and to refine it and to more precisely measure what is called the Hubble constant, which is the constant of proportionality between distance and speed. But I would just today, as I was preparing to talk to you, I came across an article in the Sky and Telescope magazine, the December issue, December 2005, that talks about the fact that there certainly has been controversy over the Hubble law, whether it's accurate or not, whether it's even correct. whether we can assume that once we measure redshift, we know the distance. And there's a small article at the front of the magazine that has some interesting evidence questioning its validity and actually questioning the Big Bang concept. It's not a widely spread question or concern at this point, but there are some people who have been talking about this for a number of years. So I'd like to kind of end with that idea. It's an intriguing one that is worth further observation and kind of following where it might go. The basic issue is this. There are images that the Hubble Space Telescope has taken and other telescopes that have taken that show two objects in an image. One is a major galaxy, and the other is a smaller object, very bright object, beside it. And when they measure the redshifts of the two things, the redshift of the large galaxy is a particular number, and the measure of the redshift of the smaller object is much larger redshift, so they believe that in general, that would mean that smaller object is much, much farther away than the main galaxy. And on the other hand, on closer examination of the images, they see that there appears to be a connection between the two objects, a physical connection, actual matter connecting the major galaxy with the smaller object, which they've been calling a quasar up to this point. So the controversy is this. How can the large galaxy have a different redshift than the smaller quasar and yet be connected? It's a dichotomy that hasn't been, or it's a contradiction, saying that if it doesn't have the same redshift, then they have to be two different distances away. The quasar would have to be much further away. But if there's a physical connection, they're at the same position in the universe. So it is enough to intrigue some people, and presumably the scientists are going to have to wrestle with this, and it will be interesting to watch that particular controversy because it has a major potential impact on the idea of the Big Bang and the questions that are being developed in cosmology. So I'm ending here with this idea simply because it's a very practical example and a current example where the measurement of supernovae, redshift, Doppler shift, Hubble law, those kinds of measurements of distance in our universe are being carried out, and where we need to watch further for what may happen. So it's a potential for a major shift in how astronomers and astrophysicists think about the universe. So thank you very much.
Elhangzott. Rich Lohmann, Measuring Size and Distance in Astronomy. Méret és távolságmérés a csillagászatban. Angol nyelvű előadás. A felvétel az első pesti egyetemi rádió stúdiójában 2005. decemberében készült.